Yeah, that the question about Woodward and the role that mechanism played in his thinking about synthesis and about natural products generally, I think that was a very important component in Woodward's intellectual bag of tricks. That's a almost derogatory way of putting it, but he had a very good feeling for mechanism, and it was not the Hammett type of thing. It was not based upon the kind of quantitative understanding of thermodynamics and kinetics that Hammett had, but it was an intuitive feeling about how reactions go, and it was sort of the Robinsonian arrow pushing raised to a higher level, and tied in much more in a much more formal way with resonance theory. It was almost entirely resonance theory. I should say this also about the Dering experience that I had. Despite the fact that in 1951, 2 years after I left Columbia, Dering had already synthesized tropone, which was the first compound in which the existence of a non-benzenoid aromatic sextet was recognized. The first existing compound. An extremely important paper, and it was published simultaneously with a paper by Hip Dauben, who was then at Washington, who also synthesized tropone. Now, that was the first place that anybody ever mentioned Erich Hückel, to my knowledge, in the whole field of organic chemistry. This guy was totally ignored until Dering put him on the map in 1951. Yet the strange thing was that in 1946-47, when I took Dering's course in advanced organic chemistry at Columbia, he did not mention Erich Hückel, he did not mention molecular orbital theory. The whole course was based upon resonance theory. So somewhere in there, Dering saw the light, and where that came from, I don't know. So if you ever have occasion to interview Bill Dering about that period in his life, that's a very interesting period. Incidentally, I don't know that I particularly want this to be. So in any case, the message I'm trying to convey is that at some point around the late 1940s to early 50s, Dering was already at a changeover point in which he was beginning to recognize the importance of speaking from the point of view of molecular orbital chemistry. Now, where that came from in his thinking, I don't know. I wanted to find out, but I still really don't know, and that's something to explore. But so I'm getting pretty far afield from Woodward now. What we were talking about, Woodward's use of mechanistic thinking, and his use, and it was based on resonance theory, largely on resonance theory. The same was true of Stork. And in fact, most people in organic chemistry argued theoretical points, electronic points, in terms of resonance theory. This was certainly true of Weinstein, was certainly true of H.C. Brown, was true of Cram, Roberts, all the people that were at the forefront of the field in those days. Now, it's true that Roberts, somewhere around the middle 1950s, became sufficiently familiar with molecular orbital theory so that he wrote this very nice book on Notes on Molecular Orbital Calculations, which was very influential.
They were teaching themselves,
that's right. Yeah, they were teaching themselves with a lot of help from this fellow that Jack Roberts quotes in his... the guy at UCLA. a buddy of his. It may have been McMillan, yeah. Yeah, I think that's who it was. Yeah, in any case, that's whom Roberts credits with essentially simplifying the thing enough. I mean,
they were students together.
They may have been at one time, yeah, at UCLA, right. So in any case, yes, it's true that Roberts and Streitwiezer were doing this, but it's very interesting also that tends to get lost in the shuffle. And nowadays when people, this is something I want to talk to you about in your paper, because when you talk about the development of molecular orbital theory in this country, you don't really talk about Huckel very much. You talk about Streitwiezer and Roberts. And I would say that's true as far as their influence is concerned, but there is a gap there of more than something like 30 years between the time Huckel did his work and the time this thing came to the general attention of the chemical public.
What the public was, early 1930s?
1931, the first paper was 1931.
But nobody was trained in that area. I mean, I came much later. I wasn't trained in that area.
Look, Huckel was just, it's all his fault. His career, his Laufbahn, the tragedy of Huckel is his own fault. And I try to make that clear in my book. Well, it's a long story, but fundamentally, he was left on the outside, and all of this stuff had to be rediscovered, essentially. Well, he was rejected. He was a physicist. He never was a chemist, and he was just trying to make it with the physicists. And the physicists looked at this stuff, and they curled their lip and they said, "Pah, organic chemistry." So he was rejected by the physicists. The German organic chemists certainly didn't understand what the hell the guy was talking about, and he didn't have the ability to sell his work, to bring it into a form where a chemist could understand it and use it. And that's a big talent. That's a very important thing to be able to do.
I mean, Roberts makes this point about form.
Yeah, absolutely.
In my paper, if Mulliken had Pauling's personality, we would have perhaps been using MO theory.
Yeah, maybe so.
A lot sooner.
That's right.
I mean, he talks about
that's
spending
right.
some time in Cambridge. Mulliken was there. And he said he's Saturday afternoon, I remember sitting at St. John's College, and coming away he wasn't sure what was going on. Whereas Pauling, who was not only brilliant, but was a brilliant salesman.
Oh, he was. He was a terrific salesman. But, in effect, he sold us a bill of goods with his resonance theory because it didn't work. It didn't work on two of the biggest problems in organic chemistry of our century, namely aromaticity and another aromaticity problem, which is the theory, the orbital symmetry theory, which is really kind of a branch of aromaticity. It's the aromaticity of transition states, but it's the same problem. And resonance theory does not give you a clue. Simple resonance theory does not give you a clue to how to talk about those problems. So in a sense, that was a cul-de-sac that people were charmed into by Pauling's enormous influence on the field. He was just dazzling, just dynamic, and everybody wanted to follow him and emulate him. But this thing wasn't going anywhere as long as people were doing valence bond theory the way he was doing it. Now, ultimately, in the 1980s or so, people like Oosterhoff figured out what was missing in valence bond theory that would allow it to be applicable to the kind of problems that people were really interested in organic chemistry. And it turns out that you can't truncate the basis set, which is what Pauling, you can't truncate it as severely as he did, with all these nearest neighbor interactions and the single perturbations. You have to do multiple perturbations, and when you do that, you get the same, you get all the Huckel results. You get the magic numbers and all of the aromaticity things from valence bond theory. So So valence bond theory and molecular orbital theory are not that disparate. They both are approximations, approximate solutions of the Schrödinger equation, and at some point they must converge if quantum mechanics is at all correct. But it took a long time for people to recognize that, and the fortunate thing about Huckel was Huckel did both of these at first. Huckel's theory is just as approximate as Pauling's, maybe more so. But when Huckel did his original approximations in the 1930s, he could see, he had in front of him the idea that you have to account for the aromatic sextet. And that valence bond theory, if you truncate it in the way that Pauling subsequently did, was not going to lead you there, and there were just too many functions that had to be permuted. It was too big a problem mathematically. The molecular orbital thing could be truncated quite severely, but it nevertheless gave you immediately, just automatically, like that. All these energy levels fell out, you filled them up two at a time, and boom, there's aromaticity. So that's what convinced Huckel at the time to reject this simplified valence bond method of doing the problem and concentrate on molecular orbital theory. And he was absolutely correct until the advent of digital computers, which then, by much later in the game, allowed you to do either problem to much higher levels of approximation. And when you do the valence bond problem correctly, you get the answer. Yeah, his brother. I know.
The H plus H2 reaction,
and they went on to lithium hydride.
Right.
They really worked very hard on that.
Exactly.
And they thought that the comparison with experiment was to get the bond length of lithium hydride to within a gnat's eyebrow. Wow, that's theory. But Huckel got this idea about organic chemistry from two sources. One was from Bohr, of all people. He had been a postdoc with Bohr, and Bohr told him, well, you might want to take a look at double bonds, carbon-carbon double bonds and other kinds of double bonds in organic chemistry. Very interesting problem. And the other thing was that Huckel's brother was Walter, an organic chemist. So he had, in a sense, a special set of a kind of background that other theoreticians simply didn't have. And Pauling certainly didn't have.
At some point, we have to talk about when you got interested, you finished your postdoctoral work. Did you interact with any of the other chemists there were a lot of people there.
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of people out there.
When you were at Harvard.
Well,
did you have any contact with Paul Bartlett?
Some, but very small. I mean, I was working so hard in Woodward's lab that I didn't really take time to go to Bartlett's seminars, and that was a mistake. I should have done that. And it wasn't until I came back on sabbatical 10 years later I did that. But Bartlett's influence was pervasive around the department, and I knew several of his students at that time. I'm trying to remember some of the names.
I'm mainly not so much in who was there, but who did you interact with, who did you talk with?
I spent a lot of time, of course, with Woodward, but also with...
You actually did spend time with Woodward.
Oh yes, a lot of time with Woodward. Woodward
was
accessible at that time. He'd come into the lab. And people in the lab would tremble a little bit because he was kind of a loose cannon. My lab partner, Flash Georgian, this was before the days of recycling, would pour ether residues down the sink. And Woodward would come into the lab smoking, and he'd sit down at my desk and facing me, and then he'd be... 5 feet away from the sink, and when he was finished with his cigarette, he'd flip it into the sink every once in a while. But he came in and he was very interested in what I was doing, and he had lots of ideas, and I tried my best to follow them. His seminars, of course, went on till all hours, and everybody interacted with him then. But he was very close to his students then, and I think the stage of large scale natural product synthesis was just beginning, about the time I was leaving Harvard, because that's when the steroid synthesis project began. And the people on that project were people like Franz Sontheimer, Dave Taub, this is really shameful, I can't remember. There was a Swiss, or that was much later. Yeah, NC is considerably younger than I am. NC didn't get there till probably 57 or something like that. Maybe. Oh, well, so it must have been. But I didn't, we didn't overlap, I don't think. He overlapped with, I wonder if he didn't overlap with Gerhard Kloss, who was with Woodward in the 50s on the strychnine synthesis. No, on the chlorophyll problem. No, that couldn't, so it couldn't have been, couldn't have been an overlap. Anyway, I can't remember, but I certainly did not know NC at Harvard. I knew, I spent some time with Gilbert Stork, and he was very helpful and very, it was clear that he was still an assistant professor, but it was clear that he was brilliant and had a great future ahead of him. And he was very accessible and very open, very, you know, Gilbert, he's a nice guy. And I knew Dick Turner, I knew Marshall Gates at that time. They were available, and, you know, we spent time discussing chemistry with them. Derek Barton was there that year and gave lectures on the conformational analysis. And so that's the first time I ever heard that thing exposed in so much detail. I didn't spend much time with Fieser, who was kind of remote. But Woodward... Woodward was at a stage then when he had a lot of individual problems being done. Gerbach's thing was working on patulin. McNamara was working on... not McNamara. Oh, this is terrible. The lab was right across the hall from mine. He was very helpful to me. And damn it, I can't remember his name. I called him Mac all the time. So, but it was not McNamara. It was a name with Mac in it. I'll think of it eventually. Was working on an alkaloid problem. Ernie Wenkert was working on some alkaloid problem. Jerry Meinwald, I think, was also working on an alkaloid problem. I mean, all these were not massive teams of researchers. But when that began was just about the time I was leaving. Franz Sontheimer came in sort of in the middle of the year. We overlapped for a while. Dave Taub was there, and he was beginning to accumulate this Heusler. That's his name. That's the name I was trying to think of a moment ago. Heusler worked on the steroid synthesis. Hans or Hendrik, I can't remember. Heusler. He was either Swiss or German. I think Swiss. And there were just a very large group of people who went to work on that problem. And then things became more and more sort of institutionalized, and the massive teams of people that he brought together to work on problems like strychnine synthesis, reserpine synthesis, chlorophyll synthesis, all of that came much after my time. So I didn't really get to experience that way of doing chemistry. It's just as well that I didn't, because we'll discuss in a moment, my resources available to me at USC were not, I mean, it was just laughable for me to try to do that kind of chemistry there. So the answer to your question is, I did not interact strongly with the physical organic people at that time in Bartlett's group or any of the other groups. I guess the only other one that was active, well, Westheimer's group didn't get started till later. Wasn't even there yet. And so I'm trying to think of who were the other physical organic. There may not have been any. No tenured faculty, certainly. Maybe an assistant professor, I'm not sure. But in any case, there was no one who made a big impression on me. I mean, Bartlett made a big impression, but just because of who he was, not because of any strong interaction I had with him. No. Just no. Cope was around at that time, but I wouldn't have seen those people unless they came to the Woodward seminars. Now, as I recall, my interaction with the MIT people began a decade later when I was back on sabbatical. Then I got to know George Busey and some of the other people, Fred Green, Gardner Swain, yeah. So those people I got to know then.
Tell me a bit about your math background.
Well, it was spotty. I was always very interested in it, but I was never very good at it. And I had the misfortune of testing out rather strongly on the math placement test, I guess, when I entered City College. So they put me into an advanced class, and I really wasn't ready for that. And this again has to do with the fact that I went through high school like a breeze, and I didn't really have, I mean, somebody should have just slowed me down and said, look, you got to take this, and this. There's stuff you just don't know. So I kind of floundered in that advanced calculus course, and I never really developed any mathematical savoir-faire or know-how after that. So my formal training in mathematics stopped with calculus. So we did things like multiple integration and so on, but I've had very little formal mathematics. I never had a course in differential equations, for example. Although, subsequently, when I started doing kinetic work, I obviously had to learn something about that, and one had to do that then, because this was long before the days of canned computer programs that allowed you to simulate all these things and get the rate constants out without knowing any mathematics whatsoever. You had to derive all this stuff, and it also just just to jump the gun a little bit, it imposed upon us a kind of a formality in the style with which we design problems in physical organic chemistry. And that is that we frequently design problems in to have closed mathematical solutions. Solutions that gave you integrable equations. Now this is the kind of thing that for me was epitomized in the work of Hughes on the SN2 reaction. And the reason that thing made such an enormous impact was that he was a problem that had been set up so that the solution came only from a deep understanding of what the kinetics were all about. And Hughes had to derive those kinetics, but it was a very ticklish kind of derivation because superimposed upon the kinetic changes in the reacting system itself was the decay of the iodide isotope, which was a non-trivial thing because it was going on at a pretty fast rate. It was going on competitively with the reaction itself. So you had to compensate for that, and this made the kinetic equations very complicated. So I sweat through that, but everybody, I think, was conditioned to avoid setting up a physical organic problem so that it had a kind of open-ended solution, which we would require if you were going to do, if you're going to integrate the equations, if you're going to follow the thing as a function of time using rate constants, then you had to be able to integrate those things, and there was no way of doing that in most instances. But when the machine integration came in with matrix inversion and that whole business of just turning the thing over to a canned program, all of this became kind of trivial. And everybody was doing simulations then. So that was another thing in a way that led to the demise of the peculiar expertise of the old-fashioned physical organic chemist. That is, those who were in the know could solve kinetic problems and devise experiments that required kinetic solutions, but later on anybody could do it because you didn't have to be able to do that, and so we lost a lot of cachet then. That our priestly position, as it were, was undermined. So that's a diversion. So. Yeah, so that there was a case really of a kind of it's a parallel is in natural products chemistry. The old fashioned natural products chemist, somebody by like Loix or Robinson, who hammered away at the strychnine molecule for decades, chipping off pieces and reconstructing little bits of the structure only by chemical transformations. Not one single spectroscopic tool, and yet they put the whole structure together pretty much. Of course, the problem was solved in the end by Woodward, with the aid of infrared spectroscopy. But fundamentally, they did the bulk of the work without doing that. But when instrumentation came in, particularly NMR, all those people were back numbers. Particularly X-ray crystallography. Those people, there isn't even a field now of organic chemistry that is called structure of natural products. It's a branch of analytical chemistry. If you can get the stuff as crystals, you send it out and you know what the structure is in a couple of days. So that's sort of technological unemployment, you see, and the parallel thing came in physical organic chemistry with these computers. To some extent. So how did I get to be a physical organic chemist? Well, it didn't happen at Harvard. I can tell you that. I left Harvard thinking I was going to be a synthetic and natural products organic chemist. And I went through hell before I finally got an academic job, and I did it, and I was there for a couple of years, and And then I began to switch to physical organic chemistry, and I'll tell you why on the next tape.